a very high five.
Phoenix has landed. Welcome to the northern plains of Mars.
Ski season is open on Mars as the Phoenix probe makes a soft landing on the polar ice. Scientists in Pasadena are looking at the first pictures of powder on the red planet. Awesome moguls, dude. Okay, it's mostly rocks and soil. This is The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Rocks and soil. Good Memorial Day morning. It's Monday, May 26. There has been some alarming weather here on Earth. What do you have to say about the presidential campaign? All weekend long, pundits discussed worries about November. Today, we're going to the U.S.-Mexico border, where professionals are helping illegal immigrants. Last week, you shared your great ideas on how airlines might raise some extra cash. Today, a travel expert weighs in. That and all the news. Severe thunderstorms, including tornadoes, have made the weekend deadly in parts of the Midwest. At least 8 people in 2 states have died. 5 people were killed in Parkersburg, Iowa, when a twister touched down in the late afternoon. This woman was devastated.
It was so sad. Everybody's in such bad shape, and I just hope that people come and help us. That's all.
In Minnesota, authorities say a 2-year-old child was killed after thunderstorms packing large hail and possible tornadoes hit the suburban St. Paul area. 9 other people were injured. Meanwhile, in Santa Cruz, California, 3,000 people are fighting a wildfire that has threatened 500 homes and is only 60% contained.
A powerful aftershock from China's earthquake has killed 6 people and increased worry about more landslides and flooding. China says 71,000 homes that survived the original quake 2 weeks ago were leveled on Sunday. The Phoenix has landed. Scientists are well over the moon about it. The lander has sent back dozens of photos from the polar region of Mars after a successful soft landing yesterday. Phoenix will be looking for evidence of the building blocks of life. More from Mars later in the show.
Barack Obama has gained 3 more superdelegates. The pickups in Hawaii put him just 49 delegates short of the 2026 needed to clinch the Democratic nomination. Hillary Clinton campaigned in Puerto Rico over the weekend. The Commonwealth's 55 delegates are up for grabs in the June 1st primary. 19 years after its first installment, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull pulled a near-record box office for the Memorial Day weekend. $25 million for Thursday's opener, followed by $101 million from Friday to Saturday, would put it behind only the Pirates of Caribbean at World's End.
Frank Buckles, the last known American-born veteran to survive World War I, was honored yesterday in Kansas City. The spry 107-year-old vet says he never thought he would survive the war. Federal officials have arranged for the Missouri native and West Virginia resident to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery. For our Memorial Day, we received this remembrance from one of you.
Hi, my name is Nez. I'm calling from Gainesboro, Tennessee. And on Monday, I will be remembering my grandfather, Wesley Knotgrass, who lived with us for 7.5 years before he died last year at the age of 92. And he was always proud of his service in World War II, and I'm proud to carry on his legacy of faith and his devotion to his country. Thank you.
Remembering Grandpa Wesley. All hour long, your thoughts on Memorial Day, on travel woes, on politics. You can weigh in with us anytime at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Memorial Day weekend, but certainly a disturbing Memorial Day for those caught in the path of tornadoes in Iowa and suburban St. Paul outside of Minneapolis. Memorial Day weekend of politics was dominated by delegate counting for Barack Obama. He received 3 additional superdelegates, pushing his total to within 50 of the total needed for the nomination. Bob Barr, after 9 ballots of the Libertarian Party, has entered the presidential race. What does that mean? Well, on the political pundit shows, it seems like holiday weekends bring out the bottom feeders on the pundit shows. It seems as though the pundits were full of reaction to something Hillary Clinton said.
Does Senator Clinton understand how tasteless, even how ghoulish, it is to even use the word assassination?
Why would you even suggest it?
She intended to say lightning could strike, anything could happen.
And as she said, if anyone took offense to what I had said, then I apologize.
She gave, my wife always says, if an apology has the word if in it, it's not a real apology.
Say goodnight, Hillary, and go away.
Ghoulish? Yikes. What did she say?
We all remember Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June in California.
The Clinton comment came last Friday in an interview with the Argus Leader, a newspaper in South Dakota, even though it wasn't quite clear what exactly Senator Clinton was getting at in the reference to Bobby Kennedy. Her remark unleashed all kinds of colorful metaphors about the state of the Democratic Party.
The future of party unity lies in them not continuing to reopen these scabs.
Better to have your enemies inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in.
I think it's poppycock, really.
Pissing metaphors from Doris Kearns Goodwin. Thank you very much. Not in terribly good taste, but what do you think Hillary Clinton was getting at?
Well, I mean, I think critics thought it was very clear that she was bringing up the suggestion that perhaps something terrible might happen to Barack Obama, ergo she's going to stay into the race until it's all said and done and the nominee is clear.
Yeah.
Of course, she says, no, I was not suggesting that at all. I was just saying that sometimes it goes down to the wire.
It's the calendar. Well, Robert Kennedy's name was mentioned in a more positive way at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, where Barack Obama was the stand-in commencement speaker for the ailing Senator Ted Kennedy.
There is nothing naive about your impulse to change the world, because all it takes is one act of service, one blow against injustice, to send forth what Robert Kennedy called that tiny ripple of hope.
So Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, even Bob Barr this weekend, you'd think there wasn't a Republican Party.
Well, that depends on who you ask, because indeed that is the case that some folks might say, depending on how you look at it, John McCain's either gotten a break from the media glare or he's simply been overlooked. Either way, in the past weeks, Republicans have lost three seats in Congress that used to be sure bets. And many say the party is in disarray. And among those voicing those concerns include the Uber Republican strategist Karl Rove. He says the party's in trouble.
Look, we're in a bad place today. But the country remains a center-right country, and the Republican agenda is more in keeping with what people want.
And for the inside scoop, we're going to turn to Mike Doyle, Washington correspondent of the McClatchy Newspapers. Mike?
Look, we're in a bad place today. But the country remains a center-right country, and the Republican agenda is more in keeping with what people want.
So what exactly is happening behind the scenes? Mike Doyle's here to tell us. He's a Washington correspondent for the McClatchy Newspapers. Good morning, Mike. Thanks for being with us. And is the party in trouble, or is it McCain's campaign in trouble?
Well, I think that two different issues, and you could answer yes to both. The Republicans themselves, as Mr. Rove conceded, are in a considerable state of anxiety right now. They have, as you indicated, lost three seats that they really should have held on to. They're looking, by some accounts, to losing 6 to 12 seats in the fall election. There's fighting at the top amongst some of the top GOP leaders themselves, and that's just on the House side of Capitol Hill. So there is objective facts behind the statement that the Republicans are in trouble.
Let's start with McCain. In the past 2 weeks, he's let go of some staff members with current ties to lobbyists. Also, he rejected the endorsement of two controversial pastors. And there's been a lot of talk about his inability to raise money and that he's riding a very thin line, which is relying on President Bush to help him raise money because Bush has been very good at it, but at the same time wanting to distance himself from President Bush because the president is suffering from all-time lows among credibility among voters, I should say.
Well, 7 of 10 voters think Bush is taking us in the wrong direction.
A bad job. So McCain has some serious obstacles ahead.
Well, he does, and this would be the time that you'd expect him to be consolidating his forces, to regroup, to be raising money, and allow the Democrats to slaughter themselves, as the Democrats so reliably do so often. And instead, there's the internal disarray within the McCain camp as they're trying to reestablish his credentials as a reformer. And when he was surrounded by lobbyists, very influential lobbyists, who are helping him map his campaign strategy that undercut his reputation as a reformer. And so this is the time when he should have been gaining ground, and instead he's struggling to sort of stay where he is.
Mike, Karl Rove a moment ago said that the nation is a center-right country and the Republican agenda is what the people want. But do you see a coherent center-right message emerging either from the party or the McCain campaign at this point?
Well, no. I think the Republicans themselves are struggling to, as they put it, rebrand themselves. Just in the last few weeks, Republican message leaders came up with a phrase. They said the new Republicans will give you, quote, change you deserve. Democrats pointed out, well, actually, that was a trademark slogan for an antidepressant called Effexor. And the Republicans were embarrassed. The Democrats were delighted. They pointed out that the side effects of Effexor include nausea, headache, and drowsiness. The Republicans changed the message, but you have to wonder if there's that much effort given to coming up with a message and that itself is bungled. There's got to be a lot of disunity within what really matters, which is what are the policy positions.
And Mike, this leads us to a really fascinating point, which is Bush's administration has been known for closing ranks, for being very disciplined. And this sniping that we are witnessing has been very public. I mean, you have retiring Representative Tom Davis putting out a 20-page memo talking about what a mess the Republican Party is in, and then comparing it to dog food that it couldn't move off the shelf. So it's just a really stunning reversal of what we've seen the last 7 years among the party.
Well, that's right. Tom Davis from Virginia, a moderate who has broken from the White House in the past, he did put out this memo essentially saying that the party's public reputation could hardly be worse. He said that he subsequently got a call from the White House. Vice President Cheney offered to go hunting with him. So there was a sense that maybe that was not well received in the White House. But Tom Davis is a smart man who understands politics better than most. And when he brings to the public's attention the declining status of the Republican Party and the prospects that the party could really lose serious seats in November, that people are going to take that seriously.
Well, Mike, on that question of losing seats, in 94, Clinton famously remarked that the president was still relevant after the Gingrich revolution. Do you think the Bush presidency is relevant to this campaign right now? And if so, where?
Well, certainly relevant to the campaign in the negative sense, at the very least, for Senator McCain, because when the president has a historically low disapproval rating or approval ratings of 30 to 31%, that tends to be a drag and anchor on the Republican who's seeking to replace him. And even though Senator McCain will make it clear to the public that he is no President Bush, he's still going to be wrapped around the poor reputation of the White House by the Democratic strategist. So, yes, the Bush presidency is highly relevant in a political sense. In a legislative sense, no, not so much. We saw that just in the last week when the president tried to stand in the way of a farm bill. He vetoed it, and he was rolled over very quickly by Republicans and Democrats alike, second veto override of the presidency. So,
But Mike, what's interesting about that is, though, this is a president that can still raise money, as we just talked about for a second earlier, but very, very quickly, because I have one quick question for you, which is, Newt Gingrich is saying the party is in for a bloodbath. Is that pure hyperbole to get the base motivated, to get organized, and make sure they get folks to the polls?
Well, it may have been hyperbole to get Newt Gingrich's name back in the paper. He's been out of the paper for a while. But I think Mr. Gingrich does have a point that bloodbath, maybe overstating it for the purposes of marketing, a real concern, which is they're very seriously concerned.
Mike Doyle, Washington correspondent, McClatchy Newspapers.
They're lowering expectations. The Republicans are lowering expectations. And Newt Gingrich probably has a book coming out.
But all of these things are cyclical. We'll see how the Republicans are doing in a month or two or three, because it's a lifetime until they vote on November 4th.
Well, they're trying to position themselves, and they do have some challenges. And I think lowering expectations is probably a plausible way to go at this point.
We'll be back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
866-869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Late yesterday, vicious thunderstorms killed seven people in Iowa and a two-year-old girl in Minnesota. Tornadoes also leveled homes as well as an Iowa high school. In Iowa, six people were killed by the storm. Holly Fokina works for Butler County, Iowa, where the Sheriff's Department reported last night that hospitals were being overwhelmed by the number of people injured by the tornado. And Holly, can you tell us what you found and how are those people doing and how many are we talking about that were injured?
The reports that I'm receiving this morning are that there's more than 70 people that have reported to local hospitals. I'm sure there's other injuries that those people probably are just taking care of those themselves.
How would you describe the devastation? We've seen some really horrific pictures.
The devastation looks like what you see on your television set when you see a war zone. I truly have never seen anything like this.
And how big is your community, Holly?
The community of Parkersburg is approximately 1,800-plus people. City of New Hartford, which was also struck, is around 650 people.
Could you hold on for 1 second, because we'd like to introduce someone from Hugo, Minnesota, and that's where the two-year-old girl was killed. Where most of the damage is concentrated is in a neighborhood called Creek View. Brian Baer is a community development director there. And Brian, a horrific story, a two-year-old girl.
Good morning. It is.
How would you describe the devastation there?
There is complete wreckage. Several homes have just been completely demolished. Others have been damaged. You've got two-by-fours sticking right through walls of buildings. You've got garages that have been cleanly torn off, vehicles strewn about, things of that nature.
And how many people do you think or believe at this point have been injured during the storm, by the storm?
At this point, we had a count of eight that had been injured, one fatality and one seriously injured.
Brian Baer, Community Development Director for the City of Hugo, Minnesota, many thanks to you, and we wish you well. Also to you too, Holly Fokina, working for the Butler County in Iowa. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In both of those communities, people have been evacuated and are being dealt with by emergency services, and hopefully we'll be able to get back to their homes today or tomorrow. Power is still out in areas around St. Paul. But we shift our focus now to a planet a little bit farther from the sun, a journey of 422 miles and a giant sigh of relief. The Phoenix lander is alive and well on Mars. Project manager Pete Smith at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory says now for the scientists, the fun begins.
This is our beginning. Without the launch, you have no mission. Without the landing, you have no mission. Now we have a mission.
The last time JPL and NASA made a successful controlled landing on Mars was back in the 1970s, and there was a lot riding on this mission to the Mars polar region.
I'd never seen a more flawless landing. I mean flawless. There wasn't any little glitch at any moment. We didn't even lose contact during the plasma phase.
Plasma phase. With more about the plasma phase and every other phase of this scientifically important mission, we're joined by Miles O'Brien, CNN space correspondent. Miles, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Even the flux capacitor was working.
Oh, that's so great. Oh, sometimes they have to put that on auxiliary.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's interesting. They said everything worked flawlessly. These things are all or nothing deals. Either they all work flawlessly, or if one thing goes wrong, it all goes to Hades. So it's one or the other. There's no middle ground when you're landing on Mars.
I mean, to be in that control room, there's no higher stakes game of poker than counting down those 7 minutes.
Yeah, I've been trying to think of another profession where you invest so much time, energy, blood, sweat, and tears over so many years. And you literally go all in with your chips, put them all on the table, and it all comes down to that. And literally, if one pyrotechnic bolt doesn't fire as it is supposed to, it's all for naught. These guys could be riverboat gamblers.
$420 million. They were all in on this one. So what's the scientific significance of this mission?
Well, this is the first time that a spacecraft is in proximity to water on Mars. It's frozen water, but it was detected by one of the orbiting spacecraft that is spinning around Mars. We've got three of them up there now. And it detected the unmistakable signature with spectrometers and so forth of ice. And so landing there and scooping some of that stuff up and putting it in some of the ovens and some of the other devices they have on the deck of that Phoenix lander will give them an opportunity to see what's inside. And water, frozen water, is a big deep freeze. What did it possibly keep in there? Could there be some organic material in there, one of the essentials for life? And if they do find that, which Viking was unable to find in 1976, the last soft landings on Mars, if they do find that, that is one more step in solving this puzzle as to what happened to life on Mars. Was it there before? Is it there now, perhaps under the surface?
And Miles, the Phoenix lander's already sent back some pictures, which are absolutely fascinating because it looks so average. You just see rocks soil, as John said.
It's $420 million to get us a picture of a parking lot,
right.
Is what it looks like.
Well, come on, you guys.
You know,
it's so cool.
It is cool.
It is.
It's not your father's Mars. It's not the Mars of the equatorial regions.
Miles, you said that last night on CNN. It's not your father's Mars. And my nine-year-old looked at me and said, what is he talking about? What do you mean it's not your father's Mars?
Didn't get the reference to the Oldsmobile ad. Huh? All right, well.
No, but it's not quite what Hollywood makes it out to be, right? There's not a whole lot of activity. It doesn't seem as if there's really much happening on Mars.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, think about going to the Northwest Territories or up in Nunavut or something where the tundra is. It would look a lot like that. They deliberately went to this place that is tundra. They knew it would be featureless like this. And a lot of people ask me, well, why didn't they send a rover? Well, take a look at that picture, and you know, you don't need to do any roving. You could drive all the way to the end of the horizon, and the terrain would be just the same. What they need is vertical mobility, which is what they have on this lander.
So, yeah, just very quickly, just describe the difference between rovers and landers for those of us who are not intimately knowledgeable about space travel.
In a word, wheels. The rovers are, Spirit and Opportunity, against all odds, 4 years later, are still moving around their regions closer to the equator. And they landed in places where there were all kinds of potentials for dried up lake beds or river beds, that sort of thing. And so the terrain is much different, hillier, rockier, that sort of thing. This has the sole purpose of going after ice under the surface. And so that's why they plopped the lander on there. It doesn't need to move. It can go as far as it would like, and it would be the same terrain, the same ice crystals that they would dig into.
And it's got a chemical laboratory in it to do some of the sampling that you're talking about. Now, they know it's water there quickly, Miles, right? I mean, there's no chance they're going to find out it's like a giant bunch of Windex or something, right? I mean, there's no chance of that.
that would be kind of interesting, wouldn't it? No, the beauty of what's going on Mars right now is they have so many spacecraft there that they know where they're going really well. The Mars Odyssey spotted this water ice. You can take it to the bank. They're going to find it. It'll be interesting to see what's in that ice.
He wishes he was there. Miles O'Brien from CNN.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, May 26th. It's Memorial Day, and we're following the deadly tornadoes in the Midwest, the death toll there at 8. We're also following the Phoenix lander. It has landed on Mars, and it sent back some pictures. Also up today, immigration this month, or I should actually say last week, immigration officials were cracking down on illegal immigrants. They arrested nearly 400 people at an Iowa slaughterhouse. And in this political year, immigration policies can be controversial, and often they are at the top of the agenda. Looking closely at the issue, there's a flourishing new problem in this post-9/11 security era, professional Mexican human smuggling rings that investigative reporter Lowell Bergman says are getting more sophisticated and more lucrative every day. Bergman's been covering the Tijuana border for nearly 40 years, or as he says, 39 years. And in his new documentary, Crimes at the Border, a joint project of Frontline World and the New York Times, he takes a look at how illegals are relying on these rings and increasingly with the help of border agents. Welcome, Lowell.
Good morning.
Can you describe the dynamics here?
Well, there are two major unintended consequences of the crackdown on the border. One is that it requires people who get across, who want to get across, to hire someone to help them. And that's led to the growth and expansion of human smuggling organizations south of the border. These are generally small organizations, family-based organizations, but very lucrative operations. And what they've also begun doing in a greater scale than before, according to the FBI and other agencies, is targeting inspectors along the border and bribing them. So you've got a flurry of cases just in the last 2 weeks. A half a dozen border inspectors have been arrested and charged across the border, and one in San Diego, in the San Diego area, which is what we're concentrating on, where there's been a series of agents who've been busted in undercover operations, making quite a bit of money, waving people through. And when you see the program tomorrow night, you'll actually see footage of inspectors waving caravans of vehicles through the border.
You have some incredibly compelling video in the documentary, and particularly before we get to the border agents, let's talk about the smuggler that you managed to get to talk to you, but let's take a quick listen to a bit of what he told you.
Yes, I was caught. Well, nothing happened. They just took me in. That time I had three people in the trunk, and so they asked me to open the trunk. So they saw the people there, and the most you're going to stay for 24 hours. It's really easy to get out, and they just put you back out along with the people you try to smuggle. So it's nothing.
So that's Rafael, the smuggler that you caught up with, explaining that basically nothing happens when he gets caught trying to get people across the border. But he's actually taking people across the border at the immigration post.
Right, exactly. The largest land crossing in the world is the border station between San Diego and Tijuana. Over 100,000 people go through there every day. And actually, as we speak, thousands of people are starting to go through the border, and there'll be thousands of illegals getting across the whole southwest border today. This is an ongoing process. It happens every day. It's happening 24 hours a day. And the border crossings, as you say, themselves are becoming the target. Because if you build a wall, when you look at the pictures of the wall we've built along the California-Mexican border, it looks something like the Iron Curtain. It's a little harder to get across as a result. So they're either going to go under it, around it, or right through it.
You've been covering this zone for 40 years, Lowell. I mean, what do you think characterizes
39.
I mean, 39 years. I mean, so many changes. I mean, this is not only covering an immigration issue, but it's a subculture. What is the one thing Americans who never get anywhere near Tijuana need to know about this border and how it works?
Well, the first thing you need to know is that we have an ongoing economic partnership with Mexico that has just been growing over the decades. So Tijuana, when I started looking at it almost 40 years ago and doing stories there, was a town of 150,000 people. Today it's over 2 million. It's bigger than San Diego. So you've got to understand that you've got a mass of people living across that border, right across on the other side of the line. But one thing hasn't changed, and that is the economic differential between the two countries. The fact that you make $5 a day in Mexico and $50 a day or more here is just sucking people into the United States. And unless you deal with the underlying causes of that, building a wall, putting a lot of fortifications up, it's going to make some bit of a difference. But the biggest difference it'll make is that people who get through that wall won't go back. So you're developing a permanent population of illegal migrants inside the country.
And what you describe now is interesting in that it's become very sophisticated, the way that these rings are enticing these border agents to help them in using sex and money, which sounds like basically an old tool, but applying it in this instance is certainly new.
Well, I think what you also got is organizations, as you pointed out, you know, when Rafael says that he gets back after he gets caught, he's just brought back to the border and allowed back into Mexico. The fact is that our judicial system cannot handle the volume of traffic. So they have a triage system. They set up criteria for prosecuting people. So, for example, on that San Ysidro border crossing near San Diego, if you're driving a vehicle with less than 12 illegal migrants in it, and they are not in any way endangered, that is, they're not locked in a compartment they can't get out of on their own, you hit the border and you're the driver, the only thing that's going to happen is your name, rank, serial number will be taken, but you'll be returned with the migrants the next morning back into Mexico.
Lowell Bergman, his new documentary, Crimes at the Border, is a joint project of the New York Times and Frontline World, a program produced at WGBH in Boston, and that program airs tomorrow night on PBS. Now time for more headlines from Femi Oke. Good morning.
Hello there, Dora. At 21 minutes to the hour, making news this morning, aftershocks in central China destroy thousands more buildings. President Bush will lay a Memorial Day wreath at Arlington Cemetery's Tomb of the Unknowns one last time as president. And in sports, the San Antonio Spurs beat the Lakers. The Lakers lead the NBA Western Conference Final Series 2-1. Former Republican Congressman Bob Barr has been elected Libertarian candidate for president. Mr. Barr has a clear idea of who might vote for him in November.
Americans who might have voted in the past Republican, who might have voted in the past Democrat, new voters, independent voters, who will be attracted to the party and the message of true individual freedom.
Bob Barr is proposing the lowering of taxes and less government involvement in people's lives as part of his campaign platform. President Robert Mugabe is threatening to throw the US ambassador out of Zimbabwe. Mr. Mugabe is furious with Ambassador James McGee for encouraging the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai to take part in the presidential runoff elections in June. Mr. Mugabe complained about Ambassador McGee's opposition support, saying, and I quote, "As long as he carries on doing that, I will kick him out of the country. This is in Zimbabwe, not an extension of America," end of quote. And, of course, we will work to bring you more on this story this week on The Takeaway.
Yes, well, I think Mugabe may have bigger problems than the U.S. ambassador at this point. But we'll see what the result of this runoff is.
Mm-hmm. Coming up in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You may have missed this story, but in a disputed land where tens of thousands have died over the past two decades, live music became a soundtrack for peace. The Pakistani band Janoon played a concert in Kashmir over the weekend. India agreed that the Sufi-inspired band could play in the Muslim-majority province. Janoon lead singer Salman Ahmed said there was an enthusiastic audience.
Our songs are about unity, love, freedom, and there's a lot of people here who want to hear those songs, and I think there's been some kind of criticism from, you know, some elements here who said that, you know, this isn't the right time. Well, my question is, you know, when is the right time? I think we have to make it the right time.
Janoon, Adar, is the first Pakistani band to play Kashmir for at least two decades. But is the concert a Woodstock moment in a place that couldn't be more disputed, that has had more violence than
I've been on the Pakistan side. I haven't been on the
beautiful
side of Kashmir.
Beautiful place. Joining us now is Altaf Hussain, a BBC reporter in Kashmir who attended the concert. Thanks for joining us. How was the audience chosen? Was it open admission or was it invitation only?
No, the audience was made up of invitees only, and but they were drawn from different walks of life. There were students from schools, there were bureaucrats, there were police officers, there were politicians. And apart from that, there were people from various South Asian countries like Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, I mean ordinary people, and there was the former president of Sri Lanka, Chandrika Kumaratunga, and there was a minister from Afghanistan, Hussein Banu. She in fact has inaugurated an exhibition of women painters from South Asian countries in Kashmir today. That's Monday.
Altaf, do you think this is a real moment of unity in South Asia, or is it more a very tense kind of symbolic little moment that may never come again?
I would say the observers do say that it reflects growing thaw in warmth in relations between India and Pakistan, who have fought at least two wars over Kashmir, or three wars in a way. But recently they have been talking between themselves. They're holding bilateral talks for the past 4 years. So, and there have been several confidence building measures between the two countries, the most significant being the bus across the line of control that divides the two parts of Kashmir respectively, mm-hmm. administered by India and Pakistan. So now there are more exchanges of people from both sides of the line of control, and this is the latest, and this is for the first time, as you said, that a Pakistani rock band has performed in Kashmir.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Sufi inspired music is?
Well, it is, it's most spiritual in content. It is, it propagates love. It rises above, it transcends religion, the rituals of religion. It's more about humanity and oneness of man.
So, Altaf Hussein, did you like the music?
Yes, everybody present.
So you're a fan? You're a fan of Janoon?
I wouldn't say I'm a fan. I wouldn't say I'm a fan.
Altaf, thank you very much for your candor and for joining us. Altaf Hussein is a BBC reporter in Kashmir who attended the Janoon concert, the first Pakistani band to play Kashmir in 2 decades.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
We have saved $100 a week on gas just by using Volkswagen Beetle. We're not sure what we're going to do. We may not go anywhere this Christmas. I don't know what to do. Bicycle, I guess.
Well, that's one suggestion, John. Get on your bicycle and go, 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 like nearly 40 million Americans this Memorial Day. They are on the road, or they are in the air, and with gas prices and a struggling economy, these are especially tough times for the airlines. New York Times travel columnist and our pal Joe Sharkey has some sobering thoughts for this traveling year. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, Edward. How are you?
Happy Memorial Day.
Thank you.
You say we're likely to see much higher fares and fewer airlines by the end of this year. That's rather bleak.
Higher fares, fewer seats. But, you've been having a lot of fun with what the airlines can do as far as raising revenue by imposing various charges. Has anybody thought of this one yet, that they could maybe drop down those oxygen masks occasionally, randomly, and have you swipe a credit card?
Pay for oxygen.
randomly.
Somebody did suggest that you pay for your pressurized cabin. Joe, I think the bleakest statement from you, though, is the fact that you didn't go anywhere this weekend. You actually stayed home.
No, I'm not.
He doesn't travel.
I'm going to get on a horse later on today. He'll do about 25 miles a day, but we're probably only going to do about 5.
There's something for your carbon footprint, but seriously, though, let's take a look at some of these three factors that are really hurting the airlines. Yeah. Fuel prices, economic downturns, the strength of foreign currency against the U.S. dollar.
On the foreign currency, don't forget the airplane flies, both directions. So in some ways, the airlines, the major airlines, with their emphasis on international travel, are gaining by the fact that there's a lot of inbound, extra inbound travel, particularly premium travel, you know, coming in as a result of the weak dollar. You know, the basic, obviously, the basic problem is airlines are not designed to operate at anything more than $60 a barrel oil, and we're, you know, we're way over double that at this point. So we're, you know, I think we're really at a fundamental change. We're really at the right at the edge of a fundamental change in air travel in this country. We've had now a good generation of American consumers who have been conditioned to expect ample, readily available, and cheap airfare.
Right.
And
right.
Those days, I fear those days, Adora, are gone perhaps forever, and if not forever, for a long, long time.
Well, let me ask you this. So you suggest that the airlines are out of cost-cutting options with the recent announcements that now they're going to charge you money for a second bag or so. And as you noted, we've had some of our listeners sending in some ideas, and many people seem to be obsessed with this notion of coin-operated bathrooms. What do you think? Is that one potential source of revenue for the airlines?
Well, no, not coin operated. Think credit card swipes. I mean, wait, this is modern technology.
True, true.
They're well, already using.
I hate to be sitting near the dude whose card was declined, though. You know what I mean? On a long flight.
But Joe, seriously, I mean, you say your best advice is to stay home. Do you mean that literally, or are there some really smart ways that people who really do want to travel, do want to see family members, is there a way for them to go about it? We have just a few seconds here.
Well, you just grit your teeth. You plan as far ahead as you possibly can. I mean, there are bursts of airfares because airlines sometimes get to the end of a month or the end of a week and say, oh, we got X number of seats available and we need to raise some cash. So look out for the bursts of airfares. They're coming hot and heavy. Virgin America had one that I think just expired. It was really a great coast-to-coast airfare. And, you know, just grit your teeth. It's going to cost you more. And plan well ahead, not just in terms of buying, but in terms of getting to the airport and, you know, getting through security. And,
so plan. That's Joe Sharkey, business travel columnist for the New York Times. That's his very optimistic advice. Thank you,
Joe.
You're
welcome. Thanks, Joe. One more hit on travel. It's not simply vacation travel that's hurting people in their wallets. The stress of gasoline prices is having an impact in the workplace. Professor Wayne Hockwater is a professor of management at Florida State University College of Business. Wayne, you've done a study on how these rising transportation prices are really increasing stress levels in the workplace. Tell me what you found.
Well, the findings were, you know, the intentions were twofold. First, to look at the magnitude of how gas prices were affecting spending behaviors. Looked at paying debt off more slowly, vacations, going without some basics. That was part of it. But my real interest was to get a better handle on: is this an issue that people take with them to work? Is it something that they think about while at work? Is it something that gets in the way of productivity and job satisfaction, increases stress, perhaps increases stress with coworkers? You know, is it one of those phenomenon that individuals can indeed leave at home, or is it something that that does follow them to work? And the research shows that for many people that they have a real hard time distancing themselves from the stress.
Well, if the stress is manifest in the workforce, that means management is going to have to actually deal with it. Joining us now is Paul Grossbard, who's a shareholder of Miller Grossbard and Associates. If Professor Hockwater is right and stress is happening in the workplace, Paul, what are you doing to deal with it in your company?
Well, several weeks ago when gasoline prices spiked over the weekend, my partner and I decided that this was a cost that was far beyond anything we had anticipated for our staff. So we made the decision that we were going to add $50 per pay period across the board to all of our staff's paychecks, which in effect we hoped would buy basically two tanks of gas a month. Now, as gas prices continue to rise, it's not quite getting there, but we feel that we're still giving them some relief.
So, Professor Hockwater, you know, a lot of companies offer ways of getting subsidies for public transit. Mm-hmm. Do you think more and more companies are going to be adopting this kind of travel allowance strategy to reduce stress on the job? Or stress on the job?
I think the bigger question is, are companies going to do something? And I don't think that there's one specific mechanism that would work, and perhaps in a smaller company something would work. And in an organization where most folks take public transportation, that might work. In some instances, telecommuting might work. In other instances, perhaps increasing the mileage allotment may work. So I think there's a lot that can be done, and I think it really, really begs this overarching question, which is, are organizations willing to step up and demonstrate a little bit of understanding and a little bit of caring and a little bit of empathy?
Well, Paul Grossbart apparently is willing to be flexible. Did your employees demand something like this, or did this come just spontaneously from you?
They did not. It really came from us. We do salary adjustments at the beginning of every year, and we've just seen cost increases in the commodity area, one that obviously impacts our staff who, you know, in a city like Houston, we have very limited mass transit. We have staff who may drive 30 miles each way every day.
But where's the bar for you, Paul, on this? Like, how much can you afford to meet this stress and this absolute need for your employees? Because it's got to cost you something.
Well, it does, and I don't know that we can answer that question yet, because we don't know where things are going to go, other than they appear to continue to be going up. You know, we've done a couple of things. We have had for some period of time a 4-10 work week during our non-very busy times of the year, which allows staff to work 4 10-hour days, and you can take off a Friday or a Monday, with the hopes of that would either both give a long weekend to those who want it and avoid one day of commute.
Well, certainly those flexible strategies are going to be really important in workplaces throughout the summer as people begin to cope with these gas prices. Paul Grossbart there in Houston, thanks for your suggestion. He's a shareholder at Miller Grossbart and Associates. And Wayne Hockwalter, professor at Florida State University, watching stress levels in the workplace. Thank you.
And certainly lots of people traveling this weekend, as we've noted. And we've been asking you to call or email us a note about who you are thinking of this Memorial Day. And this is what one of you had to say.
This Memorial Day, I am privileged to remember Poet Laureate Sam Reagan of Southern Pines, North Carolina. He loved and supported all his poets and was a source of inspiration to me. Marianne Cotard, now of Garber, Oklahoma. He remains a treasure to many of our souls. Thank you.
We'd like to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Whether it's poets or soldiers or anyone this Memorial Day, keep your responses coming to anything you've heard on today's show. It's easy to catch up with us. You can call or email anytime at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we've got a podcast and all kinds of content.
Right. In fact, if you missed our show today, you can get it all on iTunes or on our website.
Takeaway.org loves you this Memorial Day weekend. And remember, don't be like Joe Sharkey and stay home. You can get out. You can get out more. Yes. And we will see you when the work week begins tomorrow. So
right.
Have a great holiday weekend.
Yeah. Enjoy your day.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.